content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today I'll continue with the final part three of Hiroshima by John Hersey, the most downloaded and probably most well-known piece ever published by the New Yorker magazine. Taking up the entire August 23, 1946 issue, it was judged to be the finest piece of American journalism in the 20th century. If you missed parts 1 and 2, they are available as podcasts on our website, trianglereadingservice.org. Click on the New Yorker podcast in the list of podcasts, and then again on the podcast files Yorker 051719 and Yorker 052419. And now, part 3. The final part of Hiroshima by John Hersey, published August 23, 1946, in the New Yorker magazine. On August 18th, 12 days after the bomb burst, Father Kleinsorger set out on foot for Hiroshima from the novitiate with his papier-mâché suitcase in his hand. He had begun to think that this bag in which he kept his valuables had a talismanic quality because of the way he had found it after the explosion, standing handle side up in the doorway of his room, while the desk under which he had previously hidden it was in splinters all over the floor. Now he was using it to carry the yen belonging to the Society of Jesus to the Hiroshima branch of the Yokohama Specie Bank, recently opened in its half-ruined building. On the whole, he felt quite well that morning. It is true that the minor cuts he had received had not healed in 3 or 4 days, as the rector of the novitiate who had examined them had positively promised they would. But Father Kleinsorge had rested well for a week and considered that he was again ready for hard work. By now he was accustomed to the terrible scene through which he walked on his way into the city, the large rice field near the novitiate, streaked with brown, the houses on the outskirts of the city standing but decrepit, with broken windows and disheveled tiles. And then, quite suddenly, the beginning of the 4 square miles of reddish-brown scar, where nearly everything had been buffeted down and burned. Range on range of collapsed city blocks, with here and there a crude sign erected on a pile of ashes and tiles. "Sister, where are you?" "All safe, and we live at Toyosaka." Naked trees and canted telephone poles, the few standing gutted buildings only accentuating the horizontality of everything else. The Museum of Science and Industry with its dome stripped to its steel frame as if for an autopsy. The modern Chamber of Commerce building, its tower as cold, rigid, and unassailable after the blow as before. The huge, low-lying, camouflaged City Hall. The row of dowdy banks, caricaturing a shaken economic system. And in the streets, a macabre traffic, hundreds of crumpled bicycles, shells of streetcars and automobiles, all halted in mid-motion. The whole way, Father Kleinsorge was oppressed by the thought that all the damage he saw had been done in one instant by one bomb. By the time he reached the center of town, the day had become very hot. He walked to the Yokohama Bank, which was doing business in a temporary wooden stall on the ground floor of its building, deposited the money, went by the mission compound just to have another look at the wreckage, and then started back to the novitiate. About halfway there, he began to have peculiar sensations. The more or less magical suitcase, now empty, seemed suddenly terribly heavy. His knees grew weak. He felt excruciatingly tired. With a considerable expenditure of spirit, he managed to reach the novitiate. He did not think his weakness was worth mentioning to the other Jesuits. But a couple of days later, while attempting to say Mass, he had an onset of faintness, and even after 3 attempts was unable to go through with the service. And the next morning, the rector, who had examined Father Kleinsorge's apparently negligible but unhealed cuts daily, asked in surprise, "What have you done to your wounds?" They had suddenly opened wider and were swollen and inflamed. as she dressed on the morning of August 20th in the home of her sister-in-law in Kabe, not far from Nagatsuka, Mrs. Nakamura, who had suffered no cuts or burns at all, though she had been rather nauseated all through the week she and her children had spent as guests of Father Kleinsorge and the other Catholics at the novitiate, began fixing her hair and noticed, after one stroke, that her comb carried with it a whole handful of hair. The second time, the same thing happened, so she stopped combing at once. But in the next 3 or 4 days, her hair kept falling out of its own accord until she was quite bald. She began living indoors, practically in hiding. On August 26th, both she and her younger daughter, Maiko, woke up feeling extremely weak and tired, and they stayed on their bedrolls. Her son and other daughter, who had shared every experience with her during and after the bombing, felt fine. At about the same time, he lost track of the days, so hard was he working to set up a temporary place of worship in a private house he had rented in the outskirts. Mr. Tanimoto felt suddenly ill with a general malaise, weariness, and feverishness, and he, too, took to his bedroll on the floor of the half-wrecked house of a friend in the suburb of Ushida. These four did not realize it, but they were coming down with the strange, capricious disease which came later to be known as radiation sickness. Miss Sasaki lay in steady pain in the Goddess of Mercy Primary School at Hatsukaichi, the fourth station to the southwest of Hiroshima, on the electric train. An internal infection still prevented the proper setting of the compound fracture of her lower left leg. A young man who was in the same hospital, who seemed to have grown fond of her in spite of her unremitting preoccupation with her suffering, or else just pitied her because of it, lent her a Japanese translation of De Maupassant, and she tried to read the stories, but she could concentrate only for 4 or 5 minutes at a time. The hospitals and aid stations around Hiroshima were so crowded in the first few weeks after the bombing, and their staffs were so variable, depending on their health and on the unpredictable arrival of outside help, that patients had to be constantly shifted from place to place. Miss Sasaki, who had already been moved 3 times, twice by ship, was taken at the end of August to an engineering school, also at Hatsukaichi. Because her leg did not improve but swelled more and more, the doctors at the school bound it with crude splints and took her by car, on September 9th, to the Red Cross Hospital in Hiroshima. This was the first chance she had to look at the ruins of Hiroshima. The last time she had been carried through the city streets, she had been hovering on the edge of unconsciousness. Even though the wreckage had been described to her, and though she was still in pain, the sight horrified and amazed her, and there was something she noticed about it that particularly gave her the creeps. Over everything, up through the wreckage of the city, in gutters, along the river banks, tangled along among tiles and tin roofing, climbing on charred tree trunks, was a blanket of fresh, vivid, lush, optimistic green. The verdancy rose even from the foundations of ruined houses. Weeds already hid the ashes, and wildflowers were in bloom among the city's bones. The bomb had not only left the underground organ of plants intact, it had stimulated them. Everywhere there were bluets and Spanish bayonets and goosefoot, morning glories and daylilies, the hairy-fruited bean, purslane and clotbur and sesame and panic grass and feverview. Especially in a circle at the center, sickle cinna grew in extraordinary regeneration, not only standing among the charred remnants of the same plant, but pushing up in new places, among bricks and through cracks in the asphalt. It actually seemed as if a load of sickle cinna seed had been dropped along with the bomb. At the Red Cross Hospital, Miss Sasaki was put under the care of Dr. Sasaki. Now, a month after the explosion, something like order had been reestablished in the hospital, which is to say that the patients who still lay in the corridors at least had mats to sleep on, and that the supply of medicines which had been given out the first few days had been replaced, though inadequately, by contributions from other cities. Dr. Sasaki, who had had one 17-hour sleep at his home on the third night, had ever since then rested only about 6 hours a night on a mat at the hospital. He had lost 20 pounds from his very small body, and he still wore the ill-fitting glasses he had borrowed from an injured nurse. Miss Sasaki was a woman, and since she was so sick, and perhaps he afterward admitted just a little bit because she was named Sasaki, Dr. Sasaki put her on a mat in a semi-private room, which at the time had only 8 people in it. He questioned her and put down on her record card in the correct scrumped-up German in which he wrote all his records, noting that she was a medium-sized female patient in good general health and that she had a compound fracture of the left tibia with swelling of the lower left leg, that her skin and visible mucous membranes were heavily spotted with petechiae, which are hemorrhages about the size of grains of rice, or even as big as soybeans, and in addition that her head, eyes, throat, lungs, and heart were apparently normal and that she had a fever. He wanted to set her fracture and put her leg in a cast, but he had run out of plaster of Paris long since, so he just stretched her out on a mat and prescribed aspirin for her fever and glucose intravenously and diastase orally for her undernourishment, which he had not entered on her record because everyone suffered from it. She exhibited only one of the queer symptoms so many of his patients were just then beginning to show, the spot hemorrhages. Because so many people were suddenly feeling sick nearly a month after the atomic bomb was dropped, an unpleasant rumor began to move around, and eventually it made its way to the house in Kabe, where Mrs. Nakamura lay bald and ill. It was that the atomic bomb had deposited some sort of poison on Hiroshima, which would give off deadly emanations for 7 years. Nobody could go there all that time. This especially upset Mrs. Nakamura, who remembered that in a moment of confusion on the morning of the explosion, she had literally sunk her entire means of livelihood, her Sankoku sewing machine, in the small cement water tank in front of what was left of her house. Now no one would be able to go and fish it out. Up to this time, Mrs. Nakamura and her relatives had been quite resigned and passive about the moral issue of the atomic bomb. But this rumor suddenly aroused them to more hatred and resentment of America than they had felt all through the war. Japanese physicists, who knew a great deal about atomic fission, one of them owned a cyclotron, worried about lingering radiation at Hiroshima, and in mid-August, not many days after President Truman's disclosure of the type of bomb that had been dropped, they entered the city to make investigations. The first thing they did was roughly to determine a center by observing the site on which telephone poles all around the heart of town were scorched. They settled on the torii gateway of the Gokoku Shrine, right next to the parade ground of the Chongoku Regional Army Headquarters. From there, they worked north and south with Lauritsen electroscopes, which are sensitive to both beta rays and gamma rays. These indicated that the highest intensity of radioactivity near the torii was 4.4 times the average natural leak of ultra-short waves for the Earth of that area. The scientists noticed that the flash of the bomb had discolored concrete to a light reddish tint, had scaled off the surface of granite, and had scorched certain other types of building material, and that consequently the bomb had, in some places, left prints of the shadows that had been cast by its light. The experts found, for instance, a permanent shadow thrown on the roof of the Chamber of Commerce building, 220 yards from the rough center, by the structure's rectangular tower, several others in the outlook post on the top of Hypothec Bank, 2,050 yards, another in the tower of Chokoku Electric Supply Building, 800 yards, and another projected by the handle of a gas pump, 2,630 yards, and several on granite tombstones in the Gokoku Shrine, 35 yards. By triangulating these and other shadows with the objects that formed them, the scientists determined the exact center was a spot 150 yards south of the torii and a few yards southeast of the pile of ruins that had once been the Shima Hospital. Starting east and west from the actual center, the scientists in early September made new measurements, and the highest radiation they found this time was 3.9 times the natural leak. Since radiation of at least 1,000 times the natural leak would be required to cause serious effects on the human body, the scientists announced that the people could enter Hiroshima without any peril at all. As soon as this reassurance reached the household in which Mrs. Nakamura was concealing herself, or at any rate within a short time after her hair had started growing back again, her whole family relaxed their extreme hatred of America, and Mrs. Nakamura sent her brother-in-law to look for the sewing machine. It was still submerged in the water tank, and when he brought it home, she saw to her dismay that it was all rusted and useless. By the end of the first week in September, Father Kleinsorge was in bed at the novitiate with a fever of 102.2. And since he seemed to be getting worse, his colleagues decided to send him to the Catholic International Hospital in Tokyo. Father Sislik and the rector took him as far as Kobe, and a Jesuit from the city took him the rest of the way, with a message from a Kobe doctor to the Mother Superior of the International Hospital. Quote, "Think twice before you give this man blood and transfusions, because with atomic bomb patients, we aren't at all sure that if you stick needles in them, they'll stop bleeding," end quote. When Father Kleinsorge arrived at the hospital, he was terribly pale and very shaky. He complained that the bomb had upset his digestion and given him abdominal pains. His white blood count was 3,000. 5,000 to 7,000 is normal. He was seriously anemic, and his temperature was 104. A doctor who did not know much about these strange manifestations, Father Kleinsorge was one of a handful of atomic patients who had reached Tokyo, came to see him, and to the patient's face he was most encouraging. "You'll be out of here in 2 weeks," he said. But when the doctor got out in the corridor, he said to the Mother Superior, "He'll die. All these bomb people die. You'll see. They go along for a couple of weeks, and then they die." The doctor prescribed sirlimentation for Father Kleinsorge. Every 3 hours they forced some eggs or beef juice into him, and they fed him all the sugar he could stand. They gave him vitamins and iron pills and arsenic in Fowler's solution for his anemia. He confounded both the doctor's predictions. He neither died nor got up in a fortnight. Despite the fact that the message from the Kobe doctor deprived him of transfusions, which would have been the most useful therapy of all, his fever and his digestive troubles cleared up fairly quickly. His white count went up for a while, but in early October it dropped again to 3,600. Then, in 10 days, it suddenly climbed above normal to 8,800, and it finally settled at 5,800. His ridiculous scratches puzzled everyone. For a few days they would mend, and then, when he moved around, they would open again. As soon as he began to feel well, he enjoyed himself tremendously. In Hiroshima, he had been one of thousands of sufferers. In Tokyo, he was a curiosity. Young American army doctors came by the dozen to observe him. Japanese experts questioned him. A newspaper interviewed him, and once the confused doctor came and shook his head and said, "Baffling. Baffling cases, these atomic bomb people." Mrs. Nakamura lay indoors with Maiko. They both continued sick, and though Mrs. Nakamura vaguely sensed that the trouble was caused by the bomb, she was too poor to see a doctor, and so never knew exactly what the matter was. Without any treatment at all, but merely resting, they began gradually to feel better. Some of Miiko's hair fell out, and she had a tiny burn on her arm, which took months to heal. The boy, Toshio, and the older girl, Yaiko, seemed well enough, though they, too, lost some hair and occasionally had bad headaches. Toshio was still having nightmares, always about the 19-year-old mechanic, Hideo Osaki, his hero, who had been killed by the bomb. On his back with a fever of 104, Mr. Tanimoto worried about all the funerals he ought to be conducting for the deceased of his church. He thought he was just overtired from the hard work he had done since the bombing, but after the fever had persisted for a few days, he sent for a doctor. The doctor was too busy to visit him in Ushida, but he dispatched a nurse who recognized his symptoms as those of mild radiation disease and came back from time to time to give him injections of vitamin B1. A Buddhist priest, with whom Mr. Tanimoto was acquainted, called on him and suggested that moxibustion might give him relief. The priest showed the pastor how to give himself the ancient Japanese treatment by setting fire to a twist of the stimulant herb moxa placed on the wrist pulse. Mr. Tanimoto found that each moxa treatment temporarily reduced his fever 1 degree. The nurse had told him to eat as much as possible, and every few days his mother-in-law brought him vegetables and fish from Tsusu, 20 miles away where she lived. He spent a month in bed and then went 10 hours by train to his father's home in Shikoku. There he rested another month. Dr. Sasaki and his colleagues at the Red Cross Hospital watched the unprecedented disease unfold and at last evolved the theory about its nature. It had, they decided, three stages. The first stage had been all over before the doctors even knew they were dealing with a new sickness. It was the direct reaction to the bombardment of the body. At the moment, the bomb went off by neutrons, beta particles, and gamma rays. The apparently uninjured people who had died so mysteriously in the first few hours or days had succumbed in this first stage. It killed 95% of the people within a half mile of the center, and many thousands who were further away. The doctors realized in retrospect that even though most of these dead had also suffered from burns and blast effects, they had absorbed enough radiation to kill them. The rays simply destroyed body cells, caused their nuclei to degenerate, and broke their walls. Many people who did not die right away came down with nausea, headache, diarrhea, malaise, and fever, which lasted several days. Doctors could not be certain whether some of these symptoms were the result of radiation or nervous shock. The second stage set in 10 or 15 days after the bombing. The main symptom was falling hair. Diarrhea and fever, which in some cases went as high as 106, came next. 25 to 35 days after the explosion, blood disorders appeared, gums bled, the white blood cell count dropped sharply, and petechiae appeared on the skin and mucous membranes. The drop in the number of white blood corpuscles reduced the patient's capacity to resist infection. So open wounds were unusually slow in healing, and many of the sick developed sore throats and mouths. The two key symptoms on which the doctors came to base their prognosis were fever and the lowered white corpuscle count. If fever remained steady and high, the patient's chances for survival were poor. The white count almost always dropped below 4,000. A patient whose count fell below 1,000 had little hope of living. Toward the end of the second stage, if the patient survived, anemia or a drop in the blood count also set in. The third stage was the reaction that came when the body struggled to compensate for its ills. When, for instance, the white count not only returned to normal, but increased to much higher than normal levels. In this stage, many patients died of complications such as infections in the chest cavity. Most burns healed with deep layers of pink, rubbery scar tissue, known as keloid tumors. The duration of the disease varied depending on the patient's constitution and the amount of radiation he had received. Some victims recovered in a week. With others, the disease dragged on for months. As the symptoms revealed themselves, it became clear that many of them resembled the effects of overdoses of X-ray, and the doctors based their therapy on that likeness. They gave victims liver extract, blood transfusions, and vitamins, especially B1. The shortage of supplies and instruments hampered them. Allied doctors who came in after the surrender found plasma and penicillin very effective. Since the blood disorders were, in the long run, the predominant factor in the disease, some of the Japanese doctors evolved a theory as to the seat of the delayed sickness. They thought that perhaps gamma rays entering the body at the time of the explosion made the phosphorus in the victim's bones radioactive, and they in turn emitted beta particles, which, though they could not penetrate far through flesh, could enter the bone marrow where blood is manufactured and gradually tear it down. Whatever its source, the disease had some baffling quirks. Not all the patients exhibited all the main symptoms. People who had suffered flash burns were protected to a considerable extent from radiation sickness. Those who had lain quietly for days or even hours after the bombing were much less liable to get sick than those who had been active. Gray hair seldom fell out. And, as if nature were protecting man against his own ingenuity, the reproductive processes were affected for a time. Men became sterile, women had miscarriages, menstruation stopped. Giving Miss Sasaki, a local anesthetic, a Procaine, Dr. Sasaki made an incision in her leg on October 23rd to drain the infection, which still lingered on 11 weeks after the injury. In the following days, so much pus formed that he had to dress the opening each morning and evening. A week later, she complained of great pain, so he made another incision. He cut still a third on November 9th and enlarged it on the 26th. All this time, Miss Sasaki grew weaker and weaker, and her spirits fell low. One day, the young man who had lent her translation of De Maupassant at Hatsukaichi came to visit her. He told her that he was going to Kyushu, but that when he came back, he would like to see her again. She didn't care. Her leg had been so swollen and painful all along that the doctor had not even tried to set the fractures. And though an X-ray taken in November showed that the bones were mending, she could see under the sheet that her left leg was nearly 3 inches shorter than her right, and her left foot was turning inward. She thought often of the man to whom she had been engaged. Someone told her he was back from overseas. She wondered what he had heard about her injuries that made him stay away. Father Kleinsorge was discharged from the hospital in Tokyo on December 19th and took a train home. On the way, 2 days later, at Yokogawa, a stop just before Hiroshima, Dr. Fujii boarded the train. It was the first time the two men had met since before the bombing. They sat together. Dr. Fujii said he was going to the annual gathering of his family on the anniversary of his father's death. When they started talking about their experiences, the doctor was quite entertaining as he told how his place of residence kept falling into rivers. Then he asked Father Kleinsorge how he was, and the Jesuit talked about his stay in the hospital. "The doctors told me to be cautious," he said. "They ordered me to have a 2-hour nap every afternoon." Dr. Fujii said, "It's hard to be cautious in Hiroshima these days. Everyone seems to be so busy." A new municipal government set up under Allied military government direction had gone to work at last in the city hall. Citizens who had recovered from various degrees of radiation sickness were coming back by the thousand. By November 1st, the population, mostly crowded into the outskirts, was already 137,000. More than a third of the wartime peak, and the government set in motion all kinds of projects to put them to work rebuilding the city. It hired men to clear the streets and others to gather scrap iron, which they sorted and piled in mountains opposite the city hall. Some returning residents were putting up their own shanties and huts and planting small squares of winter wheat beside them. But the city also authorized and built 400 one-family barracks. Utilities were repaired, electric lights shone again, trams started running, and employees of the waterworks fixed 70,000 leaks in mains and plumbing. A planning conference with an enthusiastic young military government officer, Lieutenant John D. Montgomery of Kalamazoo, as its advisor, began to consider what sort of city the new Hiroshima should be. The ruined city had flourished and had been an inviting target, mainly because it had been one of the most important military command and communication centers in Japan, and would have become the imperial headquarters had the islands been invaded and Tokyo been captured. Now there would be no huge military establishments to help revive the city. The planning conference, at a loss as to just what importance Hiroshima could have, fell back on rather vague cultural and paving projects. It drew maps with avenues 100 yards wide and thought seriously of preserving the half-ruined Museum of Science and Industry more or less as it was, as a monument to the disaster, and naming it the Institute of International Amity. Statistical workers gathered what figures they could on the effects of the bomb. They reported that 78,150 people had been killed, 13,983 were missing, and 37,424 had been injured. No one in the city government pretended that these figures were accurate, though the Americans accepted them as official. And as the months went by, and more hundreds of corpses were dug up from the ruins, and as the number of unclaimed urns of ashes at the Zenpoji Temple in Koi rose into the thousands, the statisticians began to say that at least 100,000 people had lost their lives in the bombing. Since many people died of a combination of causes, it was impossible to figure out exactly how many were killed by each cause. But the statisticians calculated that about 25% had died of direct burns from the bomb, about 50% from other injuries, and about 20% as a result of radiation effects. The statisticians' figures on property damage were more reliable. 62,000 out of 90,000 buildings destroyed, and 6,000 more damaged beyond repair. In the heart of the city, they found only 5 modern buildings that could be used again without major repairs. This small number was by no means the fault of flimsy Japanese construction. In fact, since the 1923 earthquake, Japanese building regulation had required that the roof of each large building be able to bear a minimum load of 70 pounds per square foot, whereas American regulations do not normally specify more than 40 pounds per square foot. Scientists swarmed into the city. Some of them measured the force that had been necessary to shift marble gravestones in the cemeteries, to knock over 22 of the 47 railroad cars in the yards at Hiroshima Station, to lift and move the concrete roadway on one of the bridges, and to perform other noteworthy acts of strength, and concluded that the pressure exerted by the explosion varied from 5.3 to 8.0 tons per square yard. Others found that mica, of which the melting point is 900 degrees centigrade, had fused on granite gravestones 380 yards from the center. That telephone poles of Cryptomeria japonica, whose carbonization temperature is 240 degrees centigrade, had been charred at 440 yards from the center. And that the surface of gray tiles of the type used in Hiroshima, whose melting point is 1300 degrees centigrade, had dissolved at 600 yards, and after examining other significant ashes and melted bits, they concluded that the bomb's heat on the ground at the center must have been 6,000 degrees centigrade. And for measurements of radiation, which involved, among other things, the scraping up of fission fragments from roof troughs and drain pipes as far away as the suburb of Takusu, 3,300 yards from the center, they learned some far more important facts about the nature of the bomb. General MacArthur's headquarters systematically censored all mention of the bomb in Japanese scientific publications. But soon, the fruit of the scientists' calculations became common knowledge among Japanese physicists, doctors, chemists, journalists, professors, and, no doubt, those statesmen and military men who were still in circulation. Long before the American public had been told, most of the scientists and lots of non-scientists in Japan knew, from the calculations of Japanese nuclear physicists, that a uranium bomb had exploded at Hiroshima and a more powerful one of plutonium at Nagasaki. They also knew that theoretically 10 times as powerful or 20 could be developed. The Japanese scientists thought they knew the exact height at which the bomb at Hiroshima was exploded and the approximate weight of the uranium used. They estimated that, even with the primitive bomb used at Hiroshima, it would require a shelter of concrete 50 inches thick to protect a human being entirely from radiation sickness. The scientists had these and other details, which remained subject to security in the United States, printed and mimeographed and bound into little books. The Americans knew of the existence of these, but tracing them and seeing that they did not fall into the wrong hands would have obliged the occupying authorities to set up, for this one purpose alone, an enormous police system in Japan. Although the Japanese scientists were somewhat amused at the efforts of the conquerors to keep security on atomic fission. Late in February 1946, a friend of Miss Sasaki's called on Father Kleinsorge and asked him to visit her in the hospital. She had been growing more and more depressed and morbid, and she seemed little interested in living. Father Kleinsorge went to see her several times. On his first visit, he kept the conversation general, formal, and yet vaguely sympathetic, and did not mention religion. Miss Sasaki herself brought it up the second time he dropped in on her. Evidently, she had had some talks with a Catholic, and she asked bluntly, "If your God is so good and kind, how can he let people suffer like this?" She made a gesture which took in her shrunken leg and the other patients in her room, and Hiroshima as a whole. "My child," Father Kleinsorge said, "man is not now in the condition God intended. He has fallen from grace through sin." And he went on to explain all the reasons for everything. Late in February 1946, a friend of Miss Sasaki's called on Father Kleinsorger and asked her to visit him in the hospital. It came to Mrs. Nakamura's attention that a carpenter from Kabe was building a number of wooden shanties in Hiroshima, which he rented for 50 yen a month, $3.33 at the fixed rate of exchange. Mrs. Nakamura had lost the certificates for her bonds and other wartime savings, but fortunately she had copied off all the numbers just a few days before the bombing and had taken the list to Kabe, and so, when her hair had grown in enough for her to be presentable, she went to her bank in Hiroshima, and a clerk there told her that after checking her numbers against the records, the bank would give her money. As soon as she got it, she rented one of the carpenter's shacks. It was in Noborichō, near the site of her former house, and though its floor was dirt and it was dark inside, it was at least a home in Hiroshima, and she was no longer dependent on the charity of her in-laws. During the spring, she cleared away some nearby wreckage and planted a vegetable garden. She cooked with utensils and ate off plates she scavenged from the debris. She sent Maiko to the kindergarten, which the Jesuits reopened, and the two older children attended Noborichō Primary School, which, for want of buildings, held classes out of doors. Toshio wanted to study to be a mechanic, like his hero, Hideo Osaki. Prices were high. By midsummer, Mrs. Nakamura's savings were gone. She sold some of her clothes to get food, and she had once had several expensive kimonos, but during the war, one had been stolen. She had given one to her sister, who had been bombed out in Tokoyuma, and she had lost a couple in the Hiroshima bombing, and now she sold her last one. It brought only 100 yen, which did not last long. In June, she went to Father Kleinsorger for advice about how to get along, and in early August, she was still considering the two alternatives he suggested, taking work as a domestic for some of the Allied occupation forces, or borrowing from her relatives enough money, about 500 yen, or a bit more than $30, to repair her rusty sewing machine and resume the work of a seamstress. When Mr. Tanimoto returned from Shikoku, he draped a tent he owned over the roof of the badly damaged house he had rented in Yoshida. The roof still leaked, but he conducted services in the damp living room. He began thinking about raising money to restore his church in the city. He became quite friendly with Father Kleinsorger and saw the Jesuits often. He envied them their church's wealth. They seemed to be able to do everything they wanted. He had nothing to work with except his own energy, and that was not what it had been. The Society of Jesus had been the first institution to build a relatively permanent shanty in the ruins of Hiroshima. That had been while Father Kleinsorger was in the hospital. As soon as he got back, he began living in the shack, and he and another priest, Father Lederman, who had joined him in the mission, arranged for the purchase of three of the standardized barracks, which the city was selling at 7,000 yen apiece. They put two together, end to end, and made a pretty chapel of them. They ate in the third. When the materials were available, they commissioned a contractor to build a three-story mission house exactly like the one that had been destroyed in the fire. In the compound, carpenters cut timbers, gouged mortises, shaped tenons, and whittled scores of wooden pegs and bored holes for them, until all the parts of the house were in a neat pile. Then, in 3 days, they put the whole thing together like an oriental puzzle, without any nails at all. Father Kleinsorger was finding it hard, as Dr. Fuji had suggested he would, to be cautious and to take his naps. He went out every day on foot to call on Japanese Catholics and prospective converts. As the months went by, he grew more and more tired. In June, he read an article in the Hiroshima Chugoku warning survivors against working too hard. But what could he do? By July, he was worn out, and early in August, almost exactly on the anniversary of the bombing, he went back to the Catholic International Hospital in Tokyo for a month's rest. Whether or not Father Kleinsorger's answers to Miss Sasaki's questions about life were final and absolute truths, she seemed quickly to draw physical strength from them. Dr. Sasaki noticed it and congratulated Father Kleinsorger. By April 15th, her temperature and white count were normal, and the infection in the wound was beginning to clear up. On the 20th, there was almost no pus, and for the first time she jerked along the corridor on crutches. 5 days later, the wound had begun to heal, and on the last day of the month, she was discharged. During the early summer, she prepared herself for conversion to Catholicism. In that period, she had ups and downs. Her depressions were deep. She knew she would always be a cripple. Her fiancé never came to see her. There was nothing for her to do except read and look out from her house on a hillside in Coy, across the ruins of the city where her parents and brother died. She was nervous, and any sudden noise made her put her hands quickly to her throat. Her leg still hurt. She rubbed it, often, and patted it, as if to console it. It took 6 months for the Red Cross Hospital, and even longer for Dr. Sasaki, to get back to normal. Until the city restored electric power, the hospital had to limp along with the aid of a Japanese army generator in its backyard. Operating tables, x-ray machines, dentist chairs, everything complicated and essential came in, a trickle of charity from other cities. In Japan, face is important even to institutions, and long before the Red Cross Hospital was back to par on basic medical equipment, its directors put up a new yellow brick veneer facade, so the hospital became the handsomest building in Hiroshima from the street. For the first 4 months, Dr. Sasaki was the only surgeon on the staff, and he almost never left the building. Then gradually he began to take an interest in his own life again. He got married in March. He gained back some of the weight he lost, but his appetite remained only fair. Before the bombing, he used to eat 4 rice balls at every meal, but a year after, he could only manage 2. He felt tired all the time. "But I have to realize," he said, "that the whole community is tired." A year after the bomb was dropped, Miss Sasaki was a cripple. Mrs. Nakamura was destitute. Father Kleinsorge was back in the hospital. Dr. Sasaki was not capable of the work he once could do. Dr. Fujii had lost the 31-room hospital it took him so many years to acquire and had no prospects of rebuilding it. Mr. Tanimoto's church had been ruined, and he no longer had his exceptional vitality. The lives of these 6 people, who were among the luckiest in Hiroshima, would never be the same. What they thought of their experiences and of the use of the atomic bomb was, of course, not unanimous. One feeling they did seem to share, however, was a curious kind of elated community spirit. Something like that of the Londoners after their blitz, a pride in the way they and their fellow survivors had stood up to a dreadful ordeal. Just before the anniversary, Mr. Tanimoto wrote in a letter to an American some words which expressed this feeling. He wrote, "What a heartbreaking scene this was the first night. About midnight, I landed on the riverbank. So many injured people lied on the ground that I made my way by striding over them, repeating, 'Excuse me.' I forwarded and carried a tub of water with me and gave a cup of water to each one of them. They raised their upper bodies slowly and accepted a cup of water with a bow and drank quietly, and, spilling any remnant, gave back a cup with a hearty expression of their thankfulness and said, 'I couldn't help my sister who was buried under the house because I had to take care of my mother who got a deep wound on her eye, and our house soon set fire and we hardly escaped. Look, I lost my home, my family, and at last myself bitterly injured. But now I have gotten my mind today to dedicate what I have and to complete the war for our country's sake.' Thus they pledged to me. Even women and children did the same. Being entirely tired, I lied down on the ground among them, but I couldn't sleep at all. Next morning, I found many men and women dead, whom I gave water last night. But to my great surprise, I never heard anyone cry in disorder. even though they suffered in great agony. They died in silence, with no grudge, setting their teeth to bear it, all for the country. Dr. Y. Hiraiwa, professor of Hiroshima University of Literature and Science, and one of my church members was buried by the bomb under the two-storied house with his son, a student of Tokyo University. Both of them could not move an inch under tremendously heavy pressure, and the house already caught fire. His son said, "Father, we can do nothing except make up our mind to consecrate our lives for the country. Let us give banzai to our emperor." Then the father followed after his son. "Tino haika, banzai, banzai, banzai." In the result, Dr. Hiraiwa said, "Strange to say, I felt calm and bright and peaceful spirit in my heart when I chanted banzai to Tenno." Afterward, his son got out and digged down and pulled out his father, and thus they were saved. In thinking of their experience of that time, Dr. Hiraiwa repeated, "What a fortunate that we are Japanese. It was my first time I ever tasted such a beautiful spirit when I decided to die for our emperor." Meshkayoku Nobutoki, a student of girls' high school, Hiroshima Jazabuin, and a daughter of my church member, was taking rest with her friends beside the heavy fence of the Buddhist temple. At the moment the atomic bomb was dropped, the fence fell upon them. They could not move a bit under such a heavy fence, and then smoke entered into even a crack and choked their breath. One of the girls began to sing Kimi ga yo, our national anthem, and others followed in chorus and died. Meanwhile, one of them found a crack and struggled hard to get out. When she was taken in the Red Cross hospital, she told how her friends died, tracing back in her memory to singing in chorus our national anthem. They were just 13 years old. Yes, people of Hiroshima died manly in the atomic bombing, believing that it was for the emperor's sake. A surprising number of the people of Hiroshima remained more or less indifferent about the ethics of using the bomb. Possibly they were too terrified by it to want to think about it at all. Not many of them even bothered to find out much about what it was like. Mrs. Nakamura's conception of it and awe of it was typical. "The atom bomb," she would say when asked about it, "is the size of a matchbox. The heat of it was 6,000 times that of the sun. It exploded in the air. There is some radium in it. I don't know just how it works, but when the radium is put together, it explodes." And as for the use of the bomb, she would say, "It was war, and we had to expect it." And then she would add, "Shikata ganai," a Japanese expression as common as and corresponding to the Russian word nichivo. It can't be helped. "Oh, well, too bad," Dr. Fuji said approximately the same thing about the use of the bomb to Father Kleinsorger one evening in German. "Da ist nichts zu machen." There's nothing to be done about it. Many citizens of Hiroshima, however, continued to feel a hatred for Americans, which nothing could possibly erase. "I see," Dr. Sasaki once said, "that they are holding a trial for war criminals in Tokyo just now. I think they ought to try the men who decided to use the bomb, and they should hang them all." Father Kleinsorge and the other German Jesuit priest, who as foreigners could be expected to take a relatively detached view, often discussed the ethics of using the bomb. One of them, Father Seems, who was out at Nagatsuka at the time of the attack, wrote in a report to the Holy Roman See in Rome, quote, "Some of us consider the bomb in the same category as poison gas and were against its use on the civilian population. Others were of the opinion that in total war, as was carried on in Japan, there was no difference between civilians and soldiers, and that the bomb itself was an effective force tending to end the bloodshed, warning Japan to surrender and thus to avoid total destruction. It seems logical that he who supports total war in principle cannot complain of a war against civilians. The crux of the matter is whether the total war in its present form is justifiable, even when it serves a just purpose. The crux of the matter is whether total war in its present form is justifiable even when it serves a just purpose. Does it not have material and spiritual evil as its consequences, which far exceed whatever good might result? When will our moralists give us a clear answer to this question? It would be impossible to say what horrors were embedded in the minds of the children who lived through the day of the bombing in Hiroshima. On the surface, their recollections, months after the disaster, were of an exhilarating adventure. Toshio Nakamura, who was 10 at the time of the bombing, was soon able to talk freely, even gaily, about the experience. And a few weeks before the anniversary, he wrote the following matter-of-fact essay for his teacher at Nobori Cho Primary School. He wrote, "The day before the bomb, I went for a swim. In the morning, I was eating peanuts. I saw a light. I was knocked to little sister's sleeping place. When we were saved, I could only see as far as the tram. My mother and I started to pack our things. The neighbors were walking around burned and bleeding. Hataya-san told me to run away with her. I said I wanted to wait for my mother. We went to the park. A whirlwind came. At night, a gas tank burned, and I saw the reflection in the river. We stayed in the park one night. Next day, I went to Taiko Bridge and met my girlfriends, Kikuki and Murakami. They were looking for their mothers. But Kikuki's mother was wounded, and Murakami's mother, alas, was dead." And now, I will read a few excerpts from an article written for the April 22, 2019 version of the New Yorker magazine about John Hersey by Nicholas Lehman. What everybody knows about John Hersey is that he wrote Hiroshima, the one widely read book about the effects of nuclear war. Its place in the canon is assured, not only because it was a major literary achievement, but also because reporters haven't had another chance to produce an on-the-scene account of a city recently blasted by a nuclear weapon. Yet Hersey was more of a figure than one Megatron-weighted fact about him would indicate. By the time Hersey reached his mid-30s, he had worked as an assistant to Sinclair Lewis, the first American to win the Nobel Prize in Literature, and as a reporter for Henry Luce, the founder of Time Life. He had published 5 books about the Second World War, 2 works of nonfiction, and 3 heavily researched novels. Hiroshima is still probably the best-known piece the New Yorker has ever published. When it appeared in August 1946, it took up an entire issue, a signal the magazine has chosen to send only that once. Its publication marked the end of the magazine's founding era and the beginning of its maturity. Before the war, the New Yorker was, as Treglown puts it, generally associated with light entertainment. Its psychic home was the kind of nightclub where Hersey had encountered Sean. During the war, Sean began to function as the magazine's de facto editor. It was Sean who commissioned Hersey to go to Hiroshima and who edited the article. By the end of the war, the magazine had become far broader in its concerns, trading in its characteristic urbane blending into sneering tone for a journalistic core of moral engagement. Hiroshima can also be explained in a prosaically journalistic way. Sean and Hersey grasped that an on-site report on the effects of the first-ever atomic bomb attack would be a monster story. That they were so obviously right obscures how unobvious the idea was at the time, which is why Hersey had the story pretty much to himself. The pressing necessity of winning the war and the nationalistic spirit that accompanied it meant that even very good reporters were completely comfortable writing about Japs and measuring the American effort solely in terms of its progress toward victory. But Hersey had been grown weary of being made to include peppy local color in his wartime dispatches from Asia, which is one reason that he gradually shifted his journalistic base from the Time to the New Yorker. Then, too, Hiroshima was a marvel of journalistic engineering. Someone had given Hersey a copy of Thornton Wilder's 1927 novel, The Bridge of San Luis Rey, to read on the destroyer that took him to East Asia, and he adopted the novel's technique of braiding the stories of an ensemble of characters. From the dozens of people he interviewed, he chose six, alternating among them, so that each character appeared in every major phase of the chronology. Hersey's writing voice is calmly recitative, bordering on affectless, deliberately quiet, as he later put it. Hersey didn't have to sell the story or make an argument. There's nothing in the account about whether Truman was right to drop the bomb rather than to stage a more conventional invasion of Japan. Hiroshima is told entirely in an unadorned, omniscient third-person voice, which is why it's often called the first nonfiction novel. Well, we've run out of time for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading it. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. Today's broadcast, as well as all previous New Yorker readings, are available as podcasts at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. For comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Well, that's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.